Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Greater Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and, of course, the views of our guest. And for the next hour, our guest is going to be Michael Shaw, and we're going to be talking about sustainable development. Now, really, what is sustainable development? Well, certainly Michael will be talking a great deal about it this evening, but if you substitute the word socialism for sustainable development, why, you understand what it's about, because it's really all about control. In fact, the whole idea of sustainable development is that there's a problem out there, we've got to be afraid of that problem, and the solution is to give more power to government so they can solve the problem. And of course, in the final analysis, it is basically an effort to destroy Western civilization. Why? Because, of course, they are pushing towards the Kyoto Protocol as far as global warming is concerned. And if we were to sign the Kyoto Protocol and go along with what it advocates, we would have to, of course, actually reduce our energy consumption to that of where we were in the 1991 by a considerable percent. With that, it would mean we would have to stop consuming electricity. We'd simply have to turn off our industrial capacity, cut back massively on our industrialized or our production here in the United States. And this is why every communist in the world who hates America is advocating this. Every socialist, and of course many of the people of great wealth in this country who hate our country, who are dedicated to transferring our jobs and our wealth overseas, are behind the Kyoto Protocol, and this is an integral part of sustainable development. Well, let's go ahead and get Michael on here, because he spent a lot of time studying this. His organization, Freedom Advocates, which is located here in Santa Cruz, has a great deal of important information on sustainable development and global warming, information that you need to have so you can discuss this intelligently. Michael, thank you very much for being with us again tonight.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stan. It's a pleasure to be here. You know, sustainable development in general, people just need to understand, sustainable development is transforming America. I say that often on radio shows or with speech presentations that I make. And I need to be a little more specific, obviously, about what the transformation is. So I'm going to talk for just a few minutes about what we've talked about in the past, just to bring a summary, and then I want to talk about the specific attack on private property that is ushered under sustainable development philosophy and policy. But in general, we've talked about the nature of sustainable development politics. The governance of sustainable development is designed to be a global governance with global to local outlets for implementing this global governance scene. Now, we've also talked about the nature of sustainable development economics. It is designed not so clearly to be old-fashioned socialism where the government controls everything, but a system of public-private partnerships, usually characterized as fascism, a nasty cousin to socialist economic policy. The public-private property partnership means exactly what it says. It means the government picks out the buddies that it wants to build the housing in a neighborhood and pays them taxpayer dollars to subsidize them while they build to the government's design. It's happening all over Santa Cruz and across the country. It's usually called smart growth or affordable housing programs. But either way, what it does is advance the economics, the fascist economics. It is the cornerstone of sustainable development.
And we're going to be back here in just a moment with Michael Shaw, as he explores this whole concept of sustainable development and, of course, how it's being applied in your community without your knowledge. Go right ahead, Michael.
Well, the other aspect to the economic element of sustainable development is that it incorporates a trade policy, so-called free trade, but what we're really talking about is managed free trade. It is designed to destroy national sovereignty. Every country, the essence of every country's sovereignty is the ability to establish trade policy. Now, there's smart trade policies and there's dumb trade policies, but when you abandon your trade policy, you abandon your ability over time to govern an area mass at all. So when we really boil down the political objectives, we see that they're being well served by the economic objectives of destroying national sovereignty through bogus managed free trade policies and public-private partnership, meaning, you know, this is what Hitler did, you know, the Fuhrer picks his buddies to do the business in the country. And that is the economic system of sustainable development. You say, well, wait a minute, you know, people aren't going to accept a global system of governance that doesn't recognize unalienable rights or basic human freedoms, coupled with an economic system that's just a repeat of what we saw in the middle of the last century. People won't accept that. But there's another element to what they call the three E's, equity meaning a new system of governance and justice, and economics meaning a new system of economics. The third E in their big expression is the environment. And by fooling us as to these environmental issues, the crises that they create, they expect that we'll accept the philosophy of sustainable development designed to protect the environment, even though it comes with a cost of tyranny, where global interests rule all human action through an increasingly sophisticated technological capability that allows them to control human action. From our economy to our trade policies, all things are incorporated up and spewed out by way of sustainable development, politics, and philosophy. So the environment is what trips people into this system. They become environmental warriors, not understanding that what they're fighting for is the implementation of a world order that denies us our economic or personal freedoms.
And they really think, of course, they're campaigning for save the little animals in the wilderness and save the trees and save the forests, and they don't understand they're being manipulated, they're being used.
Well, that's right. And, you know, a system of justice that makes sense, you know, the equal system of justice that our forefathers envisioned for this country.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Michael Shaw. I'm simply talking about the three E's that the environmentalists use, and certainly the economy is one of those, equity is one of them, but the third is environmentalism, the three E's that they use, and they're using the environmental movement to bring about their corporate fascist society, because the solution to every single environmental problem is a new series of government control over our lives. And how easy it is to get young people or idealistic people to say, oh, we've got to protect those little animals. We love nature. We love the forest. And we all do. But what's the solution to the forest? Why, we're not going to allow lumbering. We're going to let it burn. In fact, as Michael has told us in previous programs, he's actually been at environmental movements and meetings where they say it's not just let it burn, but make it burn. And they're intentionally creating a situation where our forests will burn, and look at the horrible, you know, skeletons of what a once beautiful forest. But that is really what many of these environmentalists want: the destruction of the forest, the destruction of the animals in the forest, the destruction of existing society. And Michael, you pick it up from there.
Well, I think all that's right, Dr. Stan, but of course the average environmentalist doesn't connect the environmentalist programs to the political structure that's behind it. And when you don't do that, you start doing the devil's bidding. But when you really back into the circumstance of who is controlling our environmental policy in this country, it is the bureaucrats who are denying the citizens the use of their property, and it is the bureaucrats who are setting the conditions for these massive summertime forest fires throughout the West. That's because there's been a major change in policy. It's let the undergrowth grow, let the trees grow as closely as possible, and wait for the big fire. Because the objective with sustainable development land use policy is to empty 50% of the United States of all human habitation, human recreation, or human resource development.
And that really sounds so absurd. Most people find that difficult to believe, don't they, Michael?
Well, I think less and less people are finding that difficult to believe because everybody knows something's up, but they don't understand what it is, and oftentimes it is what it is that many good people are actually supporting because they're seeing a sliver of a pie and they're misinterpreting the purpose of the implementation of that pie sliver. Once they see the big picture, they need to begin to assess their own activities in terms of how it is they may be contributing to the undermining of the American system and what it is they need to do to begin to support the American system, because without it, we all become slaves.
And, Chris, we want to talk a little bit about the Wildlands Project, because I think that's so important. It explains why they're bringing the wolves back, why they're bringing the mountain lions into areas where people are living, why they want to bring the bears and the grizzly bears, you know, back into close proximity to where people live. It doesn't make any sense unless there's another agenda. So I want to talk about the Wildlands Project, because you alluded to that. It's such an important part of the environmental movement. There's not one in a thousand Americans who's ever heard of the Wildlands Project.
Well, the Sustainable Development global launch occurred in 1992 at the UN conference held in Rio de Janeiro. At that same conference was produced a prototype treaty document for the taking by all countries in the world. That treaty document was called the Biological Assessment Report, the 1,300-page document that was set to come before the U.S. Senate for ratification in 1994. And some brave people working on the inside of the UN was able to get to the U.S. Senate just days or hours before the vote was to be taken, a map based upon the implementation of this UN treaty called the Global Biodiversity Assessment Report. And that treaty, in essence, required that the U.S. put together a mapped area, roughly 50% of the land mass, away into a protected. We're starting to see these UN protection zones coming up across America, but ultimately to incorporate over 50% of our land mass into these UN protected, given away by treaty from the United States to the UN for their wildland protection zones. One has to understand that the same document calls for a world population not to exceed, if we are industrialized, 1 billion people. That means that while they take the resources out of our individual and collective hands, they expect that our population will die back dramatically. This was in the form of a treaty that when the map was saw the scene, the map that I'm describing showing the wildland areas and the smart growth zones, when this was seen by the U.S. Senate, a vote wasn't even taken. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is that presidents since then, Democrat and Republican, have taken every step imaginable to implement these UN prototypes, whether it's the Biological Diversity Assessment or whether it's the Agenda 21 Sustainable Development Education and Land Use Program. All of these programs are being implemented very actively under both Democrats and Republicans through the federal administration system. Every federal cabinet implements their avenue of sustainable development policy.
And of course, I think it's important to realize that 50% of the land is to be in the wilderness area, and that's where we'll have the wolves and the bears and the mountain lions, and all of these animals will be there, and there will be no entry for people like you and I. It won't be for recreation. It won't be something we can enjoy. It'll simply be locked up and not accessible at all. This is why they want to let the roads go. They want to get the roads out of the wilderness areas. And then another 25% of the is going to be lined up in something called the transitional areas, between where the 25% where we common people can live, if they allow us to live, because they intend to really cut back dramatically on the population, and they talk about, frankly, eliminating the vast majority of the people. And you wonder how they could do that, who could even consider that, but we're dealing with people who look at the world differently. So there'll be 25% where the remaining people will live, 25% which is transition, and 50% which is wildlands. Would that be a pretty good assessment?
Well, I think that the 25% dedicated to human use is grossly overstated. I think when we get down to the real smart growth zones, we're talking a couple percent of land mass. People are to live in high-rise structure along rail lines so that their use to society can be maximized by putting them on a train, giving them their assigned job, taking care of their children, that is, the government taking care of their children, in the collective child care facilities. You know, in Santa Cruz, the effort to create a transportation system here to facilitate so-called smart growth housing development, that means some jobs on the bottom and living above it with a train line to take people, other people for assigned jobs or to allow some movement. But inside the gates of the smart growth zone is a place you do not wander from. The goal of smart growth is to eliminate suburban housing. This is happening in Great Britain, where massive subdivisions are being simply demolished, and the people are being relocated in these public-private partnership housings all along rail lines.
And I think that's so interesting because, of course, when Prince Charles came to the United States, Prince Charles wanted to see the areas of where we had sustainable development. People don't understand. This whole scheme really was laid out on Prince Charles's yacht, the Royal Yacht, back in 1991, 1992, when all the leaders of the world, financial leaders of the world, Al Gore was there, certainly, and John Kerry, Senator John Kerry, and the elite were planning the world of the future, and that's really this whole idea of global biodiversity assessment came out of that and then was presented at the second Rio conference in 1992 and then put into the Desertification Treaty, the Kyoto Protocol, and the Biodiversity Treaty. All of these, of course, were to be enacted and, of course, were a means by eventual control by a ruling elite. There really are people who feel that they're so much smarter and superior to the rest of us that they have the right to control us. And, of course, Prince Charles is one of the leaders of that movement.
All correctly stated. Now, we've described on prior radio shows how sustainable or globalist political policy is a deadly attack on unalienable rights. Think of the unalienable rights that Thomas Jefferson or John Locke would write about. They'd summarize with the expression life, liberty, and property. Well, sustainable development has a different trio of policy that it subscribes to. First is the abolition of private property. Second, it's to create world governance based upon public decree, not individual rights. And thirdly, sustainable development is about a dramatic reduction in human population. So you can see it's taken not just the order, but the meaning of the expression life, liberty, and property, and turned it upside down.
And, of course, people find it so difficult to believe that they would actually be planning on reducing the world's population, and yet if you go to, for instance, Botswana today, and there where they test every pregnant woman for HIV disease, we don't do it here in Latin America, but they do it in Botswana, 46% of the women are HIV infected, they're all going to die. AIDS is decimating the population in South Africa, Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, Zambia, so many of the places in Africa. And here in America, what people don't understand is we've got about, you know, the 20th or 21st highest longevity rate. There are lots of other countries where people live a lot longer. Why is that? Why is our infant mortality much higher than many other places in the world? And I would suggest it's part of a population control agenda here. But we can't let the American people know that. Oh, no. Our government officials want to protect our lives, or do they? Go right ahead, Michael.
Well, I mentioned that the abolition of private property is an objective of sustainable development policy. You can find evidence of that in this same 1,300-page document, which in effect calls pretty clearly for the abolition of private property. But the policy perspectives make absolutely clear that that's the effect of sustainable development. Now, a lot of people either haven't learned or have forgotten what private property is. Let me try to make a quick, clear analysis. We're going to talk about character, and we're going to talk about essence of private property. The character is unsubsidized productive effort. It means you get up and you accomplish something. And it's about voluntary trade that's unmanaged by this type of globalist political economics, where you've got to be a partner of the government to be doing business. And that's the world we're headed for. In every county in America, there's a very active sustainable development embedding within your local government. Our federal funding mechanisms totally mandate and trigger the implementation at the local level of sustainable development policy. Here in Santa Cruz, I had a board of supervisors tell me, Michael, we can't do that. We get a lot of federal money, she said. So we sell our soul, we sell our essence, we sell our liberty so that we can collect our dollars, our tax dollars, back from the federal government. That is the reduced role that the average American has been put into by a system of implementation of these globalist sustainable policies that seek to end the era of the recognition of man's unalienable right to life, liberty, and property.
Well, certainly inherent in our form of life here in the United States was the right of private property. And if you read the Constitution, you will never see the words life and liberty together without seeing it associated with the word property. Now, of course, there are people who don't believe in life and liberty, and they certainly don't believe we should have a right to property. That's why property rights are under attack today. And the average individual doesn't understand so much of what's going on, and he sort of shakes his head. I thought that they couldn't do that sort of thing. And talking about taking people's private property under eminent domain and giving it to a developer, not for the public use, but for his development, so he can make a big profit and of course, expand the tax base of the community. People wonder how these things are happening. It's not happening by accident. It's part of a master plan. Isn't that true?
Well, I don't think there's much doubt about that anymore. And the only way you can say that is having spent some time looking at the documents, looking at their play sheet. Certainly nobody needs to imagine or conjure any action being taken by globalists that supports what we're talking about. It is their words, it is their document, and it is their action. And the "their" has become, in America, to include a whole consortium of political interests from the left and the right. I mean, both seem to have been combined under the development of sustainable policy. Both seem to combine to create the stew that makes sustainable development. You can't do it with just liberal left-wing thinking, and you can't do it without right-wing control thinking. It takes them both coming together, which is what makes sustainable development the most threatening political movement in the history of the world.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Michael Shaw. And we're simply talking about sustainable development and this master plan. Now, you're not going to read about it in your newspapers. Why? Because your newspaper is controlled. And you're not going to hear about it on radio or television, because certainly most of the television major networks are all interlocked and controlled by one of five major corporations. You'll hear about it certainly in some radio, as long as there still are private radio stations. It will sell time to those of us who want to get the truth out. But believe me, the major forces behind the media do not want the American people to understand sustainable development, or the Global Biodiversity Assessment Report, or this idea of population control, where they're planning on destroying the lives of millions and millions of people in America and hundreds of millions throughout the world, billions of people throughout the world, and the program is underway. And certainly war, disease, certainly the medicines that we're giving people, the vaccination for giving people, all harmful, but we can't tell people that. We can't tell them that we're giving influenza vaccine to foster Alzheimer's disease, because Alzheimer's disease is one of the most rapidly growing diseases in America, the seventh largest cause of death of our elderly. We can't tell the people, because they're not smart enough to accept and to understand that there are people out there with so much intelligence who have a plan for the world. And, of course, it involves massive reduction of the world population. Go ahead, Michael.
Let's go back to talking about private property. Now, the essence of private property lies in an owner's determination of use. Private property is not a thing. It is the relationship between a person and a thing. The essence of the relationship is the owner's right to determine the property's use. Now, I'm not the first person to contend this, but my contention is that the foundation of your rights and the pursuit of your happiness is, first, to be who you are, second, to own your own self and the product of your energy. Person shouldn't spend his day creating something and simply have it taken from him. And third is to possess the authority and the responsibility for your own actions. Now, I'll contend that a society that promotes happiness, promotes genuine peace, and gives rise to real prosperity. If such an ideal, such a society pursues the ideals and the institutions of individual liberty and its corollary, private property. But we're being transformed today. We're being changed from a nation rooted in private property to one based on a different system of economics. I'm going to go through five illustrations that demonstrate that transformation, if I can. The first would be eminent domain. We, as Americans, have lost the federal protection of the unalienable right to the use and enjoyment of private property. In 2006, the United States Supreme Court's decision in Kelo greatly expanded the use of a government takings power by eliminating the public use requirement of the Fifth Amendment. That decision has allowed an increasing proliferation of public-private partnerships. It used to be the court said, government can't take your property unless they're going to put your property to a public purpose, like a road or a school. And after over 200 years of Supreme Court determinations, never saying this, in 2005, the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision said, no, if the local city council wants to take your property and give it to their buddy to build affordable housing units, they can. We have lost our unalienable right to the use and enjoyment of our private property under federal law. Now, globalists and their sustainable developer friends needed Kelo to destroy the constitutional protection of private property. The court's majority betrayed the American ideal. In doing this, they opened the door for things like smart growth everywhere, the Trans-Texas Corridor coming up from Mexico and through Texas and throughout the rest of the continent, and all other kinds of globalist-minded, surreptitious actions designed to take down the American economic system.
And, of course, the Texas Corridor, the so-called NAFTA highway, they used eminent domain to seize the property from private individuals so they could give it to a private corporation, because, of course, the NAFTA highway is being built by a Spanish corporation that's going, of course, to own the land, and, of course, it's going to have the tolls, and it's going to get the money off the tolls. So why would you give eminent domain to a private corporation for a for-profit, highway that is going to be, of course, used for the profit of people in another country? Doesn't make sense. What's going on today? And you're not hearing about it through regular channels. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Michael Shaw, talking about sustainable development. Michael, go right ahead.
Well, let's talk about a second element that helps you link the dots of how sustainable development is designed to be a total control over our lives. I want to talk, secondly, on the question of the effort to abolish private property and point to the Sustainable Development Land Use Action Plans. Now, we've referred to them earlier in today's discussion. These action plans are Smart Growth and the Wildlands Project. Again, the Wildlands Project takes 50% of the U.S. and puts it off limits to the American people, including the resources that sustain our life can no longer be developed. We see that action coming apart, coming down piece by piece, closing roads, shutting off water sources, and all kinds of other shenanigans in our forest areas. Now, Smart Growth is the plan for how to house the human beings. We're to be in high-rise buildings supported by a train and bus structure for transportation, where jobs support the community needs and are assigned accordingly. Now, that's the final expression of Smart Growth. In between, it's about creating housing units that are said to be owned by their occupants, but the price at which they can sell the units and the people to whom they can sell the units are controlled by the government. This is the standard housing operation now in Santa Cruz and surrounding Central California communities and in communities across the United States. So land use is pretty well controlled. The effort for private property becomes subjugated to the Wildlands Project and Smart Growth dynamics of the Sustainable Development Land Use Plan. Now, a third area that people should be wary of is water policy. You know, I call it a third possible link to seeing the big picture can come by understanding the water policy. After all, when property is properly understood, when private property is properly understood, we come to understand that private property extends as a slice to the center of the earth. Water as a resource under my ground creates a special circumstance under property law, since the water can freely cross property boundaries as it swishes back and forth.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Michael Shaw. We're talking about sustainable development and, of course, how it applies to the individual and how they basically, of course, want to set up these high-rise buildings where they can pack people in so they can watch them, so they can control them, so they can take care and control of the children, so they can get you out of your car. Because they really hate for you having a car. That's why they want to build many of these high-rise sustainable development communities on rail lines, so you can use the railroad to get around, so you can go by bus. But if you have never seen what Agenda 21, which is the plan for the 21st century, really entails, why, of course, we have the Santa Cruz Agenda 21 report, and they, Frank, talking about plowing up the highways, doing away with the cars, at least for you common people out there, and you say that's crazy talk. But you see, it's not crazy talk. We have people who have a different view of the world because, of course, they worship a different God. We actually have the Santa Cruz County Agenda 21 program, which is a prototype for programs being introduced all throughout America, all throughout the world. Well, before we go ahead, I really do want to get Michael to get his website out there so you can learn how to reach his organization, Freedom Advocates, how to get their material, and how to start learning what this is about, and then helping get the truth out. Go ahead, Michael.
Our website is freedomadvocates.org. When you get there, you'll find plenty of audio, video, print material. We've got pamphlets and the other materials that I've just described available for sale in reproduced volumes. And our goal is to create an information bank so that local communities around the country and understand the nature of sustainable development, recognize it in their own community, and begin to organize around it, standing on the principles of liberty and justice for everyone.
But because they don't believe in liberty and justice, they want control, and it's really all about control.
Well, I'm talking about your listenership.
Right.
Understanding the nature of sustainable development is the only way you can effectively fight it. I mean, it was Sun Tzu back in the 6th century B.C. who said, you know, if you don't know your enemy, you're going to be beaten by him.
Amen to that.
So if you don't understand the global to local system called sustainable development, it is in your community, I can promise you that. You will not be able to recognize it. You might even line up on the wrong side in 40% of the occasions. And that's all they need to move their program forward. It's an old Fabian philosophy that it's two steps forward, one step back, and that's net progress. They've been doing it for a long time, and they do it by having innocent people participate in their corrupt scheme. So the only way we're going to count it is not let ourselves fall for that, and number two, understand it well enough that we can begin to explain to our neighbors, families, and friends how it is that sustainable development has snuck into our community. We're there at Freedom Advocates to help you identify or respond to sustainable dynamics happening in your community.
I wonder, how can people get in touch with your organization?
Well, you can contact us through the website, which is in the process of being updated as we speak. Or you can reach us by phone at 831-684-2232. That's 831-684-2232. And I would recommend for people who are kind of new to the subject, or even if you're not new and you want a concise expression of what sustainable development is, go to our pamphlets. We have kind of our bread and butter, a 22-page pamphlet called Understanding Sustainable Development, Agenda 21. And this will give you a good bird's-eye view. I mean, you can read it in 20 minutes and have a pretty good idea. We have another pamphlet called Transforming America, Sustainable Development, the Destruction of Your Rights, Creating Crisis, Shortage, and a police state. And you can go from these simple writings and learn more and more, gain more and more of an understanding of the specifics. You might say, oh, that sounds laborious. Well, what's important is that each of us get the gist of sustainable development, understand its threat, and then use our own talents to begin to disseminate the information. Otherwise, we're all going to be subjected to a totalitarian ending for mankind. And that may sound preposterous to some, but the system has been so embedded here in the United States, in both political parties, a full commitment to sustainable development policies. Businesses, multinationals particularly, leading the charge. You know, people here in Santa Cruz think that the environmentalists lead the charge. You know, they're just the silly window boys. Behind the scene, it is the public-private partnerships that are calling tomorrow's day under this sustainable development reign. So it's important for us to know the only way we're going to win is to fight it on the local level. There's no way to stop the UN from what it's doing unless we elect Congress people who understand what is really happening with the globalist movement today and who's ready to take thoughtful action to counteract it. Today, there aren't many congressmen like that. That's because there aren't many, not enough people in America who understand the nature of what I characterize as the most significant threat in humankind to the ideals of human liberty. So, if there was ever a time for Americans to rally up, join the cause, realize the fight isn't going to be made with guns. It was Nikita Khrushchev, after all, who said, "We will bury you without firing a shot." The process is underway. We win this battle without firing a shot by simply understanding the battle and standing up against the principles that are seeking to destroy the American experience. So let's talk a little bit about water policy. in California, property interests in water are under constant and increasing attack. In this state, sustainable development agencies are implementing what they call conjunctive use water policy. Now, one conjunctive use scheme is to transport water between aquifers via surface pipes. Now, this represents big business opportunities for the sustainable development partners. Now, the argument behind conjunctive use is that if one aquifer is fed water from a different aquifer, the resulting mixed water is no longer a property right that attaches to the overlying land. Therefore, the property right, farmer's property right to water, is lost. Right, now you can just begin to see the mechanism being made possible for getting farmers who grow what the government wants them to grow, as our diets become increasingly managed by governmental operation working with farmers who know that their only route is to become a partner with the government's objectives. So, we need to know that water becomes fully collectivized under conjunctive use rules. By collectivized, I mean that there is no private interest in the water. When there's no private interest, that doesn't mean that somebody's not making the decisions for you. What it does mean is that all the decisions are centralized. So if the objective is to move people to smart growth zones and out of rural areas, you got control of the water, well, guess what? If you abolish the private property, if you control the water, you control the people.
And I think that's really so important. I would simply point out that there are lots of things that can be done, especially in the areas where we live, where there's abundant, massive amounts of water. But every effort is made to block, you know, putting in the reservoirs and putting in the holding ponds and putting in the lakes and the things that you need so that there's adequate water. And they've sabotaged every effort to do it because they don't want the solution. They want the problem. And as long as they have a problem, then they can come up with their solution, which is control of the people and massive reduction of the use of water. And you say, well, that's crazy talk. Well, it's the same way they want to get us to quit using electricity so much. And so that's why we've got to change from incandescent light bulbs to the fluorescent light bulbs, even though the fluorescent light bulbs burn out much sooner. And they're almost all made in communist China. We have to close our factories down here in the United States and buy our fluorescent light bulbs dutifully made in red China. Why would we do that when, of course, electricity is so easy to manufacture? Well, they blocked efforts to put in means of actually creating cheap electricity. They're tearing down dams that are generating electricity. Why would you tear down dams that are generating electricity? Why would you block the development of nuclear power plants in the United States when we're subsidizing them? The U.S. government is subsidizing the nuclear power plants in China and other countries throughout the world. Why can't we have cheap, efficient nuclear energy here? We haven't built a plant in the United States for 30 years, and we probably never will because they want to create the shortages. And, Michael, it's so important people understand that they create the problem because they have a solution, and that is we've just got to, you know, stop using so much air conditioning, and we've got to stop using so much heat, you know, because, of course, the government has got to regulate us for our own good and lower our living standards. And so why should we have so much electricity when people in Africa have so little? Go right ahead.
Well, I think you're exactly right that people need to recognize that we're being set up, and that to get out of that predicament, we simply need to understand what's going on. It may be that all three leading presidential contenders are globalists. They support the globalist economic, they support the globalist political dynamic. I think we can say that the last three presidents certainly have, putting us on the verge. But as more and more people begin to understand the scheme behind sustainable development, the chances of reversing the condition become quite significant. And winds do happen along the way. We talked about the water here a moment ago. The farmers in Santa Cruz County took on the water agency that was taxing them $200 an acre foot for water so that they can construct one of these surface pipes from the Central Valley and use conjunctive water tricks on these farmers to deny them the right to the use of the water under their ground. Well, they went to court and, of course, lost at the local level, but got to appellate court and had a resounding victory based upon some very recent California Supreme Court case. And so the reality is that when you understand the sustainable takedown of your property, if you're a farmer or a rancher, or increasingly homeowners are going to be subjected to this, if you know the dynamic of what's really happening to you, you can mount good legal defenses to the taking of your land or your water or whatever. Another method, though, to gain perspective of the economic revolution in America is to understand the purpose and effect of globalist trade policy. The World Trade Organization labels globalist policy free trade. What they really want to do is manage the trade to benefit multinationals and world government advocates. This is how so many libertarians get away with being supporters, really, of this new world system. They are blind followers of a regime of free trade, even though that trade is being managed by multinational corporate firms working in concert with world governance advocates. Because if you can have trade freely crossing borders, you destroy national sovereignty. If a nation can't determine what comes in and what goes out, we can argue about what those trade policies ought to be. But if we say they ought to be none, that we ought to give that trade policy over to the World Trade Organization, then we are asking for our own ending. Globalist trade policy, so-called free trade policy, really meaning managed policy, is a core element of creating the new one world order. And it's what Americans need to begin to understand as we see this Trans-Texas Corridor coming across our national boundary, and once we begin to understand what its purpose is, what its background is, what its financing is. Globally managed economic policy, as we said earlier, destroys national sovereignty. So once free trade of this type is fully secured, time will bring world governance with unlimited power over individuals. No more unalienable rights. That concept will be gone. If we were to consider the continental trade policy that undermined European nation sovereignty, leading to the formal loss of political independence, all came via the creation of the European Union. Now, what we're seeing here is big steps being taken toward a North American Union. Trans-Texas Corridor is a perfect illustration. The North American Union concept is incompatible with the principles of the Declaration of Independence. Continental unions are the pathway that lead to world governance. Here's a fifth method for understanding the transformation in American economics as we shift from private property to public-private partnership economics. Key that people see and understand the effects of surrendering the principles of free enterprise and adopting the principles of fascism. Because that's what public-private partnership is. When local home builders receive $100,000 from the federal government to build an 800-square-foot smart growth project along the rail line, we find how public-private partnership destroys the opportunity for free enterprise. Who can compete with a guy who gets more money as a subsidy up front before, more money than what it costs to build these small stack 'em and pack 'em units? As American taxpayers, all people participate in the funding of this kind of housing dynamic. Our housing market has been undermined by the intentional attack where supply was controlled, where money was made out of thin air and driven down in price to silly levels, and now where government subsidizes home builders across the country, Santa Cruz no exception, to the tune of the price that has to be paid by the average taxpayer.
And of course, this is all about building the homes so they can pack people together, so they can watch them. They can have, of course, people watching them, because after all, they might be terrorists, and then, of course, they can control them. And they want to get you out of your car. They want you to work where they want you to. They want you to get the health care. They want you to eat the material they want you to eat. And believe me, you're going to see the progressive deterioration of the health of the American people, because so much of the advice we're getting from the government is wrong. In fact, they've only recently admitted the whole food pyramid they gave us was a mistake. Oh, shucks. Well, we should have made a mistake, but now we're going to get it right. Are you sure? Our guest has been Michael Shaw, and we're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Well, Michael, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for
us. Okay, well, let me say that everybody needs to understand and think about the transformation that's happening to our economy. We are going from a system based on private property to one based on public-private partnership. We are being transformed from free enterprise to a fascist economic system. Now, I think there are other links to begin to see how the economic transformation is occurring. Some of these investigations are the global warming swindle, what's really behind global warming science, the World Bank, banking cartel objectives, including what is the Federal Reserve, green building standards, the big rage here in Santa Cruz these days, how that contributes to understanding the economic picture. It's the energy debacle, immigration policy, perpetual war, population control, Fabian socialism, the Trilateral Commission, and so on. The dots are everywhere. It takes some energy to link them. You don't have to be new at doing this. The patterns are becoming clear. You need to pay attention to what those patterns are. You need to translate that attention to some action taken by you and others in your community. At freedomadvocates.org, we're there to help you do that. We're working to do that slowly in various places, steadily. This is not going to be an overnight win. They've got all kinds of plans prepared to back up initial plans that don't work. You never get a clean win, because they always come back on you. And that will continue until enough Americans understand how we're being set up and sold out.
And really, of course, it's up to the people of America, if they really value freedom, to find out if what Michael is saying is true. And I will tell you, it is true. I've been at this for a long time, and you've heard an excellent overview of sustainable development. And you have to be involved, because believe me, the people on the other side are involved. They spend all of their time and all of their working awakened hours plotting on how they're going to restrict your freedom. And what are you doing to preserve freedom? Because freedom is never free. Every time they pass a law, you lose a little bit of freedom. I mean, the secret to freedom is the diversification of power, the limitation of power. It is power that takes away the rights of the individual. And, of course, government, these people who are part of this whole sustainable development environmental movement, are intent upon power over your life and the lives of every person living who is allowed to continue living in America. Well, Michael, thank you so very much for being with us. We'll look forward to having you with us again next month.
And I'll look forward to that too, Dr. Stan.
Good night and God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and if you would like to get a tape of the program, remember we do talk through the breaks, and really this is an excellent, excellent overview of sustainable development. Well, of course, you can get a copy of the tape by calling 1-800-544-8927. We talked about population control. If you don't believe this is the major part of government policy, we carry here something called NSSM, the National Security Study Memorandum 200. It was released in 1974 by Henry Kissinger, and it was laid out the major thrust of American foreign and domestic policy, population control. And you can pull it down off the Internet, but we have it nicely bound and available through Radio Liberty. We actually have Dr. David MacArthur's testimony before the House Appropriations Committee on Military Affairs in 1969, where he asked for $10 million to create a new disease for which there will be no treatment and no resistance, that it can be a means of mass killing. Those are his words, not mine. Certainly you need to get the Project Daylily, a book written by our frequent guest, Dr. Garth Nicholson, one of the certainly best-known scientists in the country today, with over 600 peer-reviewed articles, the story of what happened to him and his family when they began to investigate the genocidal programs that were being carried out at Huntsville in Texas and of course, Gulf War illness. And do you know that almost 80,000 of the young men we sent off to fight for freedom in the first Gulf War are dead? We have the Veterans Administration figures, pages from their website. They're available by calling us at 1-800-544-8927. You say that couldn't be true. Everybody would know about it. And no, the truth is, you would not know about it, because you're not supposed to know. And then, of course, we have a talk I gave on DVD called None Dare Call It Genocide, going into the genocidal programs. We have a DVD, much longer, called Planned Population Reduction. We have a video called Population Control. We have a four-tape set on population control. We actually have a Population Control Agenda monograph, which you can pull down off the Internet, off our website at RadioLiberty.com. But, of course, you'll get the quotations from the various people who talk about the necessity of killing off over 90% of the world's population. And, of course, war is such an efficient means, but there are more efficient means. Of course, that would be a worldwide plague. At least that's what Bertrand Russell said, and that's why, of course, they're poisoning our water with fluoride, why they're poisoning our vaccines with mercury and aluminum, why they're poisoning our food with aspartame and MSG and genetically altered food, and they're out to poison the American people and spray them, and people find this difficult to believe. Well, we challenge you. Find out if what we're telling is the truth. If you'd like to see a copy of the UNESCO Courier, November 1991, that quotes Jacques Cousteau as talking about the necessity of killing off, eliminating, I think was the word he used, 350,000 people a day. You realize that Hitler was really just a piker. Hitler was a piker compared with Jacques Cousteau. And yet Jacques Cousteau gets a good press, and in the process, though, of killing off millions of people throughout the world on a regular basis, hundreds of millions every year. But we can't let the people know that. They wouldn't understand. Certainly, if you'd like to get our material on sustainable development, we have an excellent syllabus, a video entitled Sustainable Development, the Road to World Government, a four-tape set on sustainable development. If you'd like to understand the global warming scam, we have an excellent DVD simply called Global Warming. We have a four-tape set on global warming. We have a sustainable development syllabus. We actually have the Agenda 21 program that came out of Santa Cruz that talks about doing away with the highways and of course, getting people out of the cars. And then, of course, if you want to understand the electricity scam, we have a syllabus, a four-tape set, and a video on electricity. And, of course, we had that here in California, where we, of course, we're going to lower the price by deregulating electricity. And, of course, what happened? It doubled and tripled the cost of electricity, and they knew exactly what was going to happen. Our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.
Did not go through. Will you please try your call again? We're sorry. Your call did not go through. Will you please try your call again? We're sorry. Your call did not go through. Will you please try your call again?
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guests. And, of course, our guest for this hour is going to be Barry Shamish, who's an Israeli patriot who had actually was an investigative reporter over in Israel for many years. And he's actually written extensively on the murder of Rabin, the prime minister of Israel. And he, of course, was assassinated not by, a deranged patsy, not by an deranged individual, but by the Shin Bet, which is actually the Israeli counterpart of the FBI. And just as the murder of President Kennedy was covered up here, and of course they went after the wrong man, which is Lee Harvey Oswald, that's what they did over in Israel. And of course this death was certainly over 10 years ago, about 10 years ago or more. But you have to understand that because of Barry's writing and because of his speaking out, he has convinced almost half of the religious Jews in Israel that Rabin was assassinated as part of a government conspiracy. And of course there have been many others, and he's written about those. In fact, he was being so effective that there were attempts made at his life. He was forced to come here to America. So Israel's loss, at least for the temporary time, at this very important time in history, Israel's loss is our gain, because we have an opportunity to talk to Barry on a regular basis, get his appraisal of what's happening in the Middle East and the Near East. And you have to understand that Barry understands that the government of Israel really doesn't represent Israeli interests at all. The influence of the Council on Foreign Relations that controls America is very large there. The influence of the Vatican is very large there. And these forces that work behind the scenes are really running Israel, and are not running it to preserve Israel, but ultimately to destroy it. Well, with that as a background, Barry Shamish, thank you so much for being with us again.
Always my pleasure. I don't suppose there's any chance you open your emails tonight.
No, I haven't had a chance to.
Oh, you got a real good surprise.
All right, it'll give me something to look forward to tomorrow morning. No, I go through my emails first thing in the morning, and then I don't go back to them until the next day, because if I did, I wouldn't ever get anything accomplished. So what did you send me by the email, Barry?
Just how spot on we've been this week. I sent you the headline and the details. The PLO has asked Condoleezza Rice and the State Department to put an end to the suits against it for terrorism in the United States, claiming that the United States is sending aid to the PLO that's ultimately going to go to the victims of the terrorism. They mentioned two of the suits, one of which we mentioned briefly, and we're going to go into that, how Israel takes care of judges or a judge who goes against the PLO. But in the United States, there are two cases ruled for the plaintiffs. And I'm writing this down. I just got this evening. It hasn't all soaked in. But case number one is the victim was Aharon Ellis, murdered by the PLO in Netanya. An American court gave his family $174 million, which the PLO have to pay. And then the case that we did mention, the case of Yaron Unger, the United States, and I did mention this already, awarded him $116 million. But that's not the part that's driving the PLO crazy. In the case of Ellis...
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment, Barry. And we'll sort of get into this idea that lawsuits are being brought against the terrorist organization for terrorism. We'll be right back. You go right ahead, Barry.
Well, in the case of Ellis, the judge ordered $100 million in PLO retirement funds in an American bank frozen, and in the case of Unger, it was a little more modest. It was only $200,000 frozen in two banks, but it's still $100,200,000 worth of frozen accounts, and the PLO are going crazy because two American courts are ordering them to pay this fantastic figure for killing Americans in Israel. Now, the reason I mention this, is, well, you know the reason, but the listeners tonight don't know the reason, and I'm going to start with a complicated case, the murder of an Israeli judge who ruled exactly as the American courts ruled. The PLO have to pay for killing people. And, of course, it's a complicated issue, but the judge was Judge Adi Azar. Now, it's not going to be a simple story, and I'm kind of turning our previous interviews upside down. I'll talk about the situation in Israel at the end, and we'll talk about two murders. And I played a role in the second murder, and that we will get to, the so-called conspirator who murdered, who was set up to be the patsy for the murder of Judge Adi Azar. His name was Yitzhak Chechiavili. Now, just to let you know, this is complicated, and it's in a book of mine called Bye Bye Gaza, and that's the only way to follow all this. But Judge Adi Azar heard, he was the registrar, by the way, of the Tel Aviv courts. He was a big-time judge. And he heard two cases against the PLO. The first case was the Egged Bus Company, which sued the PLO in his court. Well, it was really awful. I mean, 54 people died on Egged buses. More than that, 54 of them were drivers. It was a terrible, terrible thing, what the PLO bombing of the Egged Bus Company did to the company. And Judge Azar awarded the Egged Bus Company, ordered, in those days, it was January of 2003, ordered Arafat to pay 164 million shekels.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Barry is talking about a recent court decisions by American courts that would reward people who had been killed by PLO terrorists large sums of money. And, of course, the PLO doesn't want to do that. After all, they're getting money from the United States. And I mean, we are financing, you have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, we're financing the PLO terrorists. We're fighting, then they're giving money to Hamas. And so we're really financing the whole terrorist movement. But then we've been doing this for a long time. The terrorists, of course, have killed, supposedly killed people. 3,000 people in Washington, D.C. came from Saudi Arabia. We fund Saudi Arabia. We help Saudi Arabia. And, of course, we fund Pakistan, that's funding the Al-Qaeda terrorists and the Taliban terrorists. And none of this makes sense. Well, anyway, because of the recent court decisions, Barry is taking us back to the murder assassination of Judge Adi Azar. And this was apparently a few years ago. Judge Azar had actually heard some cases. One of them involved a bus, and a lot of people were killed. And of course, the judge felt that the terrorists who, and the country that financed the terrorists, which was the PLO, should pay for the harm that had been done. So if you pick up the story there of the murder of Judge Adi Azar, because this is the most bizarre story you've ever heard. Go ahead.
Well, it was in July of the year 04, so it's been 2.5 years since he was murdered. And Egged was not just one bus, it was a series. It's like bombing Greyhound. Egged's the big bus company in Israel. And a lot of people died, and many people were wounded. And Judge Azar awarded Egged the equivalent of $40 million. 164 million shekels, which may not seem like a lot, but the Israeli court for any Israeli court to award $40 million is like a record high. These are not American courts. Now, that was the first decision that he made. The second was a lot more modest, but it was more significant. This was a gentleman who was harmed in the bombing of a Tel Aviv seafood restaurant, Yosef Azuz, and Azar awarded him $4 million. But here's where it gets interesting. The PLO, of course, were not at the trials. They couldn't care less what an Israeli judge thinks of them. And, well, they had a weakness. The weakness was that Israel was supplying a lot of money to the PLO.
I think that's so important, Barry. Israel is supporting money to the PLO, and the PLO is sending terrorists in to kill people in Israel. What's wrong with this picture? We'll go right ahead with the story.
Well, this was the horrible Oslo War Agreement way back in 93 that Israel would give the PLO tax returns and rebates and all kinds of money held in the Bank of Polim. Bank of Polim, leave it at that. In Tel Aviv, there's an account run by the PLO, which you can be sure is pretty dirty, but that's not the point. On December 30th of the year 04, Judge Azar ordered the PLO to show up in his court and tell the world what their assets were. Now, or he would put a lien on his bank account whatever money they could squeeze out of this bank account would go to the victims of PLO terrorism, which I repeat are the Agat Bus Company and Yosef Azuz. It was only two cases, but the precedent was enormous. Now, the PLO showed up in court, and, they don't want to disclose their assets. The last thing in the world the PLO wants to do is disclose its assets. It's asking the mafia to disclose their assets. And the PLO, I have the transcript in my book again, but the PLO claimed to have $74 million in liquid cash, and they own 15 companies. You can be sure that Arafat had more money in his piggy bank than what they claimed they had, but it was more than enough to pay the two court cases. Now, the precedent of what Azar was doing would have bankrupted the Oslo War Agreement. It simply would have put an end to all of Israel's support of the Oslo Accord. And I guess it was on December 30th when he ordered the PLO to show up in his court, and they actually did show up in his court, that the decision was made to kill him. And that, of course, came from the Shabak, our Secret Service. And I'm sure they sat down with the PLO's version of the Shabak. I could give names, but it's too confusing already. Let's just say that Israel, the Israeli Secret Service, and the Fatah Secret Service sat down early in the year of 04 and decided that they are going to murder Judge Azar. Now, it happened in July. Witnesses actually saw the murderer. It was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a hot July day. Whoever shot him was on a motorcycle. Shot him five times as he arrived home from work and then disappeared, which means there was a safe house nearby. It's not that easy to travel in Tel Aviv, especially after you murdered someone. They're going to catch you. So there was a safe house next door. Now you've got a dead judge, and Israel's never had a dead judge before. And I went looking because, now, I don't want to confuse listeners again, but rumors were immediate that Judge Azar was involved in a love triangle. And I had gone through this nonsense in the murder of Eliyahu ben Elisar, who was Israel's first ambassador to Egypt, and we'll jump to that later.
But of course, what they're really what they're trying to do is discredit the czar. So they put out all these stories, like they put out all the stories about Martin Luther King being a womanizer. Why would the FBI release stories of that sort, leak stories to the press of that, to discredit Martin Luther King? And why did the Shabbat put out the stories about Judge Azar being involved in illicit sexual affairs? To discredit him. And of course, when people are thinking about that, they're not concerned about the fact that an Israeli judge has been assassinated. Or they're not concerned here in America that Martin Luther King was assassinated. After all, he was a corrupt, no good guy, communist, and well, go right ahead.
Well, I think the difference is that Judge Azar was probably quite innocent of his sexual peccadilloes, and Martin Luther King was probably really guilty of them. He was guilty of them. I think that's the slight difference. But nonetheless, when these rumors started, I knew that they were covering up. So I started looking into Judge Azar, and I started investigating who he was, and saw how dangerous he was to the PLO, and the possibility that if he stayed alive, the PLO would be bankrupt. And then I knew between the phony love affair rumors and how dangerous this guy was, that he was murdered. Now, I had to wait a little while. I started at least the rumors that there was something extremely wrong with this murder, and it was not a romantic murder. It was not a crime of passion. And because, well, look, they didn't arrest anyone. They didn't arrest his secretary, who he was supposed to be having an affair with. She didn't hire a hired killer to knock him off. Either did his wife, and this went away. And then came the murderers about 6 months later. And my Lord in heaven, what a wallapalooza they came up with to explain who murdered him. Now, I know how the Shabak work, and I know how they set up patsies. What they do is they take innocent people who don't even know the case, and they set them up to be murderers. And this is what happened in the Rabin assassination, of course, and it's happened in so many other assassinations since then. But bear with me, folks. This is what happened. You're going to hear some strange names. The murderer was, well, he was sitting in prison on a life sentence for murdering in a business dispute. His name was Yitzhak Chechiavili. Okay, now from his little itty-bitty cell, he ordered Rafi Nachmani, also sitting in prison for murder. All these people are Georgian Jews who are kind of a, well, they've got a reputation for being, a deserved reputation, actually, for being a little on the tough side. Rafi Nachmani was a murderer who was given a furlough very early on in his life sentence. He was given a furlough.
Why would they give somebody who's in prison for life a furlough when he's only been in jail a short period of time? That doesn't make sense.
No, it sure doesn't. And more to the point, I brought that out. I brought it up. But even worse, they didn't find him for 2 years. Now,
in other words, he was went on furlough, and then he stayed away for 2 years, and he was living in the best hotels and over there. Where did he get the money to stay in the best hotels in Israel? They're expensive, and how could he escape, you know, rearrest for 2 years?
All points that I brought up. Now, I hear music.
If you're right ahead, I'll tell you when to stop.
All right. So Rafi, and by the way, why didn't the police put an all-points bulletin out for this escaped murderer who didn't return from his furlough? There are many questions about Rafi Nachmani, but he was being used by the Shabak to set up Yitzhak Chechiavili, and we will explain right now that he hired a third conspirator who knew nothing of the murder of Judge Adi Azar.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Okay.
All right, go right ahead.
His name was Avinom Hajbi. He was hired by Nachmani to be a driver, and he was sucked into a plot he knew nothing about. And this is what you have to understand. You can set up anybody to take a rap, provided you have control of the courts and the police. Anybody can be set up to commit a murder, and I've proven that, of course, with the Rabin assassination. But this judge, it was the same mentality as the Rabin assassination. Now, Nachmani probably was not the murderer because he was not driving a motorcycle, and the neighbors, five of them, all swore that the Judge Azar was murdered by someone on a motorcycle. Now, what would the motive be for Yitzhak Chechiavelli to murder Judge Azar? Now, here it is, folks, to upset the judicial system and to get leniency for his sentence. That is what was claimed, that Yitzhak Chechiavelli murdered Judge Azar to upset the judicial system and have an easier time in prison because of it. Now, did he know Judge Azar? Never heard of him. He wasn't the judge who sent him to prison. Is there a reason for killing a judge you've never heard of? None whatsoever. But he says to Rafi Nachmani, who's going on furlough, I've got a little, he supposedly says, by the way, I got a little assignment for you. While you're out, would you mind killing Judge Azar? Now, Nachmani must have said, is he the rat who sent you to the clink? To which Chechiavelli would have said, no, I never heard of him. Okay? This is stage one. Rafi Nachmani says that Chechiavelli told him to kill a judge that he had never heard of. Now, Avinom Hajbi, the driver, three times Rafi Nachmani takes Hajbi to Azar's house. He leaves for about 10 minutes and comes back into the car. On the fourth visit, the day of the murder, of course, in July of the 04, he stays outside for 20 minutes. Rafi Nachmani, he arrives at the car and hands Hajbi a gun.
Now, was it a pistol or a rifle?
It was a pistol.
All right, pistol, okay.
I believe it was the .32. And he says to Hajbi, go and bury this at Colon Beach. Just bury the gun. And Hajbi does know what's going on, of course, and he asks Nachmani, whose gun is it? What's it for? Nachmani explains to him that we used it to hurt Judge Azar so that Yitzhak Chechiavelli, so that we would upset the judicial system. Exact words, by the way, that Chechiavelli supposedly said to him, to upset the judicial system and gain leniency for Yitzhak Chechiavelli, who's sitting in prison in life for murder. Noam says, you mean to say that he'll get better conditions if he murders a judge? To which Nachmani said, yes, you murder a judge, your conditions improve.
Hold that thought here, yes. Just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Barry is telling us this incredible story. First of all, there's the judge. His name is Avinom, and he's...
Avinom.
And he basically is trying to, he's brought some cases for large financial settlements against the PLO. Well, of course, this would really upset the whole situation, the whole scam there, where Israel is financing the PLO. You've got to finance your enemies. So basically, they're going to get rid of the judge, Azar. And so there's a fellow sitting in jail named Chechiavelli, and he goes talks to another murderer, who's just been put in jail for a life sentence, and he's about to go on furlough. He's life sentence for murder, and this fellow's name is McManny. And, of course, Chechiavelli talks to McManny into going ahead and killing the judge with the idea that if he kills Judge Azar, that somehow Cerciavelli will get better treatment in prison, which doesn't make any sense, but then the whole story is contrived from the beginning to the end. McMahony eventually kills the judge, gives somebody else the gun, tells them that to bury it, and then explains that the reason they killed the judge was that Cerciavelli, who's still in prison, will get a better treatment because he's killed a judge. Pick up the story there, because, of course, it's so incredible, it has to be true.
Well, I suppose so. They have a very pixie sense of humor, the Sabak. Rafi Nachmani did not kill Judge Azar. Somebody on a motorcycle did that. They didn't trust them to actually kill the judge, I guess. But that's irrelevant, because he accepted blame for shooting the judge. And by the way, he went back to prison, and he got a pretty good deal. He got 2 years on the lam, staying in the best hotels in Israel for 2 years. And when he got back to prison, I suppose his conditions did improve. But now we have Avinom Hajbi, who buries the weapon. By the way, in court, Hajbi repeated, just like Cerciavelli, that everything is fabricated, none of this happened. Because it didn't. But Hajbi said when Nachmani told him this story about upsetting the judicial system and getting better conditions for Cerciavelli, his words were, "What is this, a science fiction film?" That's what he said. He says, "I turned to Nachmani and I said, what is this, a science fiction film?" Okay, I mean, they pick up a guy who's about to be a conspirator in a murder that he knows nothing about, and tell him this wacko story of why they're going to shoot a judge, and that's his answer in the court, in an Israeli court. What is this, a science fiction movie? In fact, it is a science fiction movie, but no one would go to see it because no one would believe this thing. It's just so fantastic. But the next part is where I come in. And believe me, it is not so fantastic when you actually play a role in this stuff. Now, I'm going to ask you the next time, before we speak next time, look at Bye Bye Gaza, look at the first chapter, look at the photographs of another murder, Raful Eitan, and you'll be well prepared for the next interview. Following that murder is, of course, the murder of Judge Azar. Now, I gave a speech on this in Jerusalem for the Root and Branch Society, and I believe I did it in February of 2005. I did the murders of Raful Eitan and Rafi and Judge Azar, and it was advertised in Haaretz and the Jerusalem Post. And I started getting phone calls. Where is it going to be? Can I bring friends? Phone calls from people who had never called me before. And I give this lecture, and there's five guys in IDF uniforms, another five Israelis who had never been to a speech of mine, and they were being, boy, were they being flattering to me, how much they admired me, how much they appreciate what I'm doing. The works. I mean, they acted like the best friends a person could ever have. Now, I introduce a new character, Yitzhak Cerciavelli's attorney. His name is, in Hebrew, is David Weiner. In English, David Weiner. He's an American. Very left-wing, idealistic attorney. And the reason I have to mention this is because I gave a speech, it ended, let's say, at 10 at night, and he was dead the next afternoon, 26 hours after I gave this speech.
The lawyer you're talking about,
yes,
was killed.
David Weiner was shot through the forehead.
And this was Cerciavelli's lawyer. So, obviously, they figured that he had told you the information, didn't realize you'd gotten this all into your own. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly I think that Barry Shamus leads a charmed life. I'm surprised that they didn't assassinate him, but instead of they assassinated the lawyer they assumed had given Barry the information. And Barry talks about how at this meeting all these people came up to flatter him and tell him how wonderful he was, and of course they obviously were trying to gain his confidence, and it's a standard technique. I mean, certainly every conservative organization I know in the United States and leading religious organization has been infiltrated by government agents who pretend to like the person so much. And of course, Michael Rupert's best friend was an FBI agent. Certainly Patriciana, who had put out the video, the Clinton Chronicles, that really I think was responsible for the 1994 Republican sweep of Congress, why they infiltrated his organization. One of the men he thought was his best friend was an FBI informant who arranged to get him set up for a lawsuit against the Pat. And this is the technique they use. They infiltrated Media Bypass. They infiltrated Michael Rupert's organization. This is what they do. One of Michael Rupert's best friends, he wrote, of course, Crossing Rubicon, one of Michael Rupert's best friends was an FBI agent. There were other agents in there. This is how they neutralize the opposition. Anybody who wants to tell the American people the truth. So when you tell me that they were there flattering you, believe me, they try to flatter me too. But when anybody tells me how great I am, I'm immediately suspicious. Go right ahead, Barry.
Well, I gave a very successful lecture, and I said what I just said to you, basically, that this is a stupid Shabak plot because Azar was endangering the PLO. And we'll talk about the other murder next time we speak. And do get Bye-Bye Gaza and look at it, and you'll see what I'm talking about. It was two photographs in the book. We can actually follow this thing. But nonetheless, I got it right. This was why Azar was murdered. He was posing a mortal threat to the PLO, and this is how it was done. They set up these three Georgians to take a rap, and they were all completely innocent, which David Weiner, either one, was starting to say that this is a complete fabrication, what's going on. My client doesn't have money. He's trapped in a little prison cell. It isn't possible. Where did that money go on the furlough? If he did return to jail, why wasn't there a nationwide manhunt?
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Barry Shamus. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Barry's telling us this incredible story of how they murdered a judge over there, and then they had their patsies to do this. These are criminals. Two of them were already in jail for life murder, murder for life. I mean, and yet one of them was let go on a furlough so he can go out and kill the judge at supposedly the behest of the other man. It doesn't really make sense. I mean, how many murderers do you know a lifetime sentence would be released in the United States so they could take a nice little furlough and then supposedly come back and then not come back, live in the best hotels in America? Where's the money going to come from? Well, of course, somebody's providing the money, but nobody ever asks these questions. Anyway, but Barry, before we go on, I want you to give our listeners your website, how they can get hold of your books, and how they can get hold of your DVDs.
Sure. Look, the book in this case is Bye-Bye Gaza, about this murder. You go to lulu.com. Just remember, the fat girl in the comics is lulu.com. It says search in the right-hand corner. Write in my name, and that's spelled C-H-A-M-I-S-H. That's how you spell Shamish, and it'll take you to the books, including, as I said, Bye-Bye Gaza. The website is officially the Barry Shamus website.com, but if you write BarryShamus.com, it'll take you there. And there, in the archives, you'll find some of the information about tonight's interview. And I do have a pretty good collection of DVDs, including the MP3 with 124 radio shows, many with Dr. Stan. from the year 2007. It's called the Best of 2007. I'll leave you my phone number, and if you're interested in others, I'll talk with you. That is 904-501-7605. That's 904-501-7605. Now we go back to Israel, where David Weiner is shot dead. Now, they claim it's a suicide. And here is the reason for this. He felt he had to prove to the prosecution that he was handling the Chechevili case honestly. This is what he said. He felt betrayed by the Israeli prosecution. And for that, you're going to kill yourself. Now, look, I don't know what's wrong with the Israeli people. I really don't. I was the only one reporting it this way. And frankly, there is no other way to report this stuff. And not if you're trying to be truthful. And nonetheless, you don't kill yourself because you felt betrayed by the Israeli prosecution. The man was 2 weeks away from his wedding. These were some of the happiest days of his life. He was not depressed. He was shot through the head is what he was. Somebody went into his apartment, that's where it happened, by the way, and shot him in the forehead. And suddenly we have another dead Israeli, and this was directly because of my lecture. All those Israelis in uniform and those flatterers, they were all there to gather what information I had about this murder, and they reported back to their chiefs, whoever they are, and it goes to the top of the Shabak. Back in 2004, that would have been Ami Ayalon was head of the Shabak then. He approved this. Remember, these are guys conducting negotiations with the PLO. He approved the murder of Judge Assar. And I know Ami Ayalon. Unfortunately, we were on the same TV show one night. Christian Barman in London, and he's just a little itty-bitty, short, bragging pisher of a man who went on before I did. And he had to, as head of the Shabak, have ordered the murder of Judge Azar and then ultimately the murder of David Weiner. Now, when I got this information, everything I had, I phoned his mother. His mother was on TV, and how confused she was, her son was not suicidal, and I suspected she must have known that her son would not commit suicide. I mean, the mother must know their son. The man was in his 40s. You would think that the mother and son knew each other better than this. She was a social worker in Tel Aviv. I tried phoning her home. I left messages at her office. I sent emails every which way. You have to meet me. They murdered your son. And, of course, I got nowhere. Nowhere. Now, no one else was writing this. And don't ask me why. Believe me, it doesn't make sense. Journalistically, it doesn't make sense. But these kind of murders take place in Israel if you endanger the peace. Now, I'm going to go on right now to another murder that... Well, for some reason, once again, I was the only one doing it properly. And I'll tell you how absurd this one is. Eliyahu Ben Elisar was Menachem Begin's chief negotiator with Anwar Sadat. He was a very nice man, looked nice, pleasant. And he, in the year 2001, he was appointed, the foreign minister was David Levy at the time, appointed him the Israeli ambassador to France. And he was murdered in that year. I guess he was appointed in 99, because in 2001, Ehud Olmert was the prime minister of Israel. In his last days, Ehud Barak. I'm sorry, if I said Olmert, I'd bite my tongue. It was Ehud Barak. Olmert is now Israel's defense minister. You know what? I'm getting confused with two Ehuds. Ehud Barak was prime minister when Eliyahu ben Elisar was murdered. Ehud Barak is today's defense minister. Olmert has nothing to do with the story. All right. Now we go to the fact that Paris, France, is where Shimon Peres, the monster. And I use that term for very few people, but this is a very, very sick man, the Shimon Peres. Many, many dead people. He's got blood pouring out of his hands, dripping on the floor, and he's the president of Israel. Paris, France, is where he did his bad stuff. Very bad stuff, including the Rabin murder. The night before the murder, the head of the Shabak, Carmi Gilon, flew to Paris, met with French intelligence. They had organized the murder with Carmi Gilon and Shimon Peres. There is so much dirt in the French embassy. And I guess Eliyahu ben Elisar discovered it when he was the ambassador to Paris, France, because he had full reign of the embassy. Now, here is what happened. He is called to meet Chirac, president of France. The prime minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, drops everything and flies to Paris to be in the meeting. It is now Chirac, then Elisar, Ben Elisar. Now, Ben Elisar must have got the goods on every crime that came out of Paris. And this, by the way, includes Mark Ritt. Let's just say there's lots of crimes for now. And the word must have gone out that this guy's got to die. Because Barak returns to Israel and immediately fires six foreign ministry officials who he claims that his predecessor, David Levy, hired, and he didn't want them anymore, including Ben Elisar. And he orders him back to Israel within 48 hours. He's trying to save Ben Elisar's life. But it doesn't work, because on the last day in France, now here is what the... Now, again, this is how they covered up the French Secret Service murder of Ben Elisar. The Israeli media, and by the way, I got phone calls from Yediot Akronot and Haaretz, major papers, wanting my take on this. They claimed that Ben Elisar went to the hotel which the Israeli embassy used in Paris. He somehow skirted his police escort, his constant two Shabak bodyguards. They all got lost. Every one of them got lost. And he entered this hotel where everyone knew him, where every guest staying at the hotel on behalf of the Israeli embassy knew him. And he walks in with two male prostitutes, goes up to a room and dies in an orgy of sadomasochistic sex. And by the way, if you ask any Israeli today, how did Eliyahu ben Elisar die, they will tell you that he was with prostitutes, either male or female, and that he was having a massive orgy and had a heart attack. He had a heart attack because someone put a needle full of air up his artery and killed him if he had a heart attack. He didn't have a heart attack out of lust. Now, I knew that a man of his stature, he might have been a homosexual, but he's sure not going to flaunt it. And by the way, I don't think he was. None of it made sense. And I wrote it. I said, it's a bunch of hooey that he walked into the hotel with two male prostitutes. And I started spreading the fact that the story made no sense. And then a funny thing happened. The embassy in Paris burnt to the ground. All six stories. It was on the third story that they said the fire started. Six stories. It was the biggest Israeli embassy in all of Western Europe. Now, they said it was an electrical short. And by the way, this was some short because the firemen arrived at midnight and put out the blaze, and the short started again at 2:30 in the morning. There were actually two separate fires in the French embassy. Now, you have to imagine what an embassy this must be. The ambassador goes home, locks the door behind him, and there's nobody in the building. Okay, I mean, that's what you have to believe. No one spotted the fire. There's not one guard inside that building taking care of the building who would spot the fire. It gets even stupider. They've got sprinklers in the building. That why would the fire put out from within? It obviously, there was just so much damaging evidence. And part of it, just part of it, was the murder of Ben Elisar. That the French wanted all traces destroyed. But Perez wanted that building destroyed for whatever Ben Elisar told Chirac and Barak. He had the goods on a lot of stuff to get himself murdered and to get that embassy burnt to the ground. But this is a story, and it's an important story, by the way. You have to understand who's running Israel and the fact that a lot of good people get killed just for doing their jobs. Judge Azar wanted the PLO to pay for murdering people, so they killed him. Ben Elisar wanted all of the corruption that he had discovered in France, and a big chunk of that directly tied to Shimon Peres. He wanted either exposed, who knows what he wanted to do with that information, but it was enough for Chirac to order him to a meeting and Barak to drop all of whatever he had to do in Israel and fly to that meeting. It must have been a beaut. So they murdered him and they set up the lurid story, which has stuck to this day in Israel, that he died in a sadomasochistic orgy. To this day, that's how everyone will tell you that Ben Elisar was died. He was murdered. That's how he died. And the French embassy, it was an electrical short. Impossible. It's never happened before. No other embassy anywhere in the world has ever, six floors no less, has ever burnt down because of an electric short. But that's what Israelis will tell you.
And of course, and there were two fires, not just one. I thought that was so interesting. The short just kept coming back again and again.
I guess because the building must have been empty and there were no guards there watching if these things happen.
Well, I can't imagine that they'd leave a building of that sort completely unattended. That just doesn't make sense. I mean, you always have a night watchman there.
I mean, look, nothing, if you're thinking rationally, makes sense. But the Israeli people, I don't know, maybe it's chemtrails. Maybe they're all poisoned and have lost the ability to think individually or something. They keep buying this stuff. The Israeli establishment keeps murdering the good people, and they keep buying the story, no matter what it is. And this has gone on and on ever since, well, I'll tell you, it's gone on a long time, but ever since that Oslo Accord was signed, it has been nonstop. The first murder was Motegur, Rabin's deputy defense minister. He was murdered in July of 1995. That was the first of the major murders, but this stuff has been going on ever since peace was signed with the PLO. You get in the way, you bother the PLO, and they will kill you. And this is why Israel is going to go down. Utter corruption has taken over at the top in a huge way, and the people are not brave enough to actually stand up and put an end to it.
Well, I think it's a tragic, tragic situation, and of course we're having the same thing here in the United States. I wonder maybe if they've been drinking too much fluoridated water, taking too many vaccines, eating too many foods with MSG and aspartame in them, or maybe the genetically modified food gets their minds. I don't know, but certainly we share a common problem. How do you get good people? Because I think the people of Israel are good people, and I think the people here are good, but they're not thinking. It's almost like there's a like some sort of a blindness among them. I agree.
Well, now how much time do we have?
You just got 1 minute now before we go to the break, and then 3 minutes after that.
All right, then I'll just stick with one little subject, and that is the murder 2 days ago of Imad Mughniya, the head of Shabak and the mastermind of the mass marine murder in Lebanon, 224 dead. There may or may not be a war or severe action against Israel over this, and I suppose I should say a few words.
All right, fine. And Chris, this gentleman you're talking about was the head of Hamas, who was recently killed in Damascus.
Hezbollah, I believe.
Hezbollah, okay, fine. And of course, I know that Nasrallah, the head of the Hezbollah there in Lebanon, is talking about going to war with Israel over this murder. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program with Barry Shamish. Well, Barry, I think that's interesting. You think this man was behind the Marine murder there in Lebanon back there in 83?
Well, if he really was head of the Hezbollah way back in 83, that was during the Lebanon War, the one war that I fought in, Hezbollah was really not a very, very strong power. They had just come into their own in 83, and he was the first leader of Hezbollah, and the Syrians, of course, funneled their money into Hezbollah so they'd have a presence in Lebanon, and everyone thinks he did the murder of the Marines, so what the heck. But as a symbol, it was in Damascus. Damascus is supposed to be a closed military city. You're not supposed to be able to get to a guy like this, and somebody must have been paid off big time to get the intelligence to know where he was and to put the bomb in the car and all that. So everyone assumes it's Israel, and frankly, I actually agree with everyone. I think this was an Israeli operation. It makes the most sense. But again, I don't see the rockets flying from Lebanon.
Well, let's be thankful that they're not flying from Lebanon.
Well, I'm not sure. Remember, they're there. You can't wish them away. They're there and aimed at Israel, and they're waiting for the right moment to be launched.
Well, but let's be thankful that it wasn't yesterday or immediately after the murder of this gentleman. Maybe
okay.
I shouldn't call him a gentleman if he was responsible for the death of those Marines back in 83.
Well, everyone's been looking for the spark that's going to cause this upcoming war. Obviously, this wasn't a good enough spark. But and Israel still has the ability to make Lebanon burn. So they're waiting for the moment when all the forces come together. And I guess they weren't prepared for this murder. It was a little sudden. But nonetheless, don't ever think that those missiles in Syria, and they're ordering them from Russia by the shipload now, aren't going to be used someday. But this didn't cause the war, and there may be incidents, but this did not cause the war. That simple.
All right, fine. Well, I guess this evening has been Barry Shamish. I hope you've enjoyed his program. If you'd like to get a tape of it, and remember, we do talk through the breaks. And, of course, then what I repeat afterwards is just what I've heard Barry saying. If you'd like to get one of the tapes of our program, why, 1-800-544-8927. Good night. God bless.
Night all. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest Barry Shamish, and once again, I would repeat, if you'd like to get a tape of tonight's program, and we do talk through the breaks, while there's a lot more information there. The tapes are available if you're interested. If you'd like to know how to get them, call us at 1-800-544-8927. Now, we have a new DVD we've just put out called The Planned Police State. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, there is a plan for a police state, And that's why they're putting the video cameras up every place. That's why they want everybody to have a RFID identification card. This is why they certainly have your credit card. They keep a record of everything you buy with your credit card or with your grocery card. Or they're collecting dossiers on every American citizen. This is why we have the children answer all these questionnaires about personal things in their homes. They're collecting dossiers on everyone. There is a move towards a planned police state, and we hope you want to get this DVD. I think it's very, very important. And then, of course, there's so much else that we have. You can go to our website at RadioLiberty.com and look at all the four tape sets and the videos that we have. Now, of course, we also have a health catalog, which has things having to do with health and fluoride and aspartame and the mercury that they're using to poison our elderly and poison our pregnant women and poison our infants. Understand that they still have mercury in the vaccines, in the influenza vaccine. They give to pregnant women, but it'll do the child in her womb the absolute worst harm, terrible harm. And then they're giving it to two-year-olds. Why are they giving two-month-old children shots laden with mercury when it's the most toxic substance in the world? And they know there's a relationship between the mercury and the autism and the autism spectrum disorders. Why would anybody do that? Why? Because they're people who have a different worldview, because they worship a different God. And believe me, they're poisoning our children. And so, anyway, if you'd like that information, you can get the reference to the items we have in the health catalog. We also have a emergency food catalog, emergency items that people would want information on. So if you'd like to get free copies of any of their catalogs, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you want to know how they have modified the weather, how they do it, why, of course, you need to get the book on weather modification, the DVD on weather modification, the four-tape set on weather modification, and then, of course, you'll want to get the DVD, pardon me, the four-tape set on HAARP, and then the book, HAARP, The Ultimate Weapon. HAARP, The Ultimate Weapon. And, of course, they do have the ability to change the weather. Why do you think we're having tornadoes in the middle of winter in the East Coast? They don't occur in the middle of winter. Well, they did occur, and they had devastating results. They've been working on weather modification for a long time, but we can't tell the American people because we don't want Osama bin Laden over there in the cave in Pakistan to know what the intelligence services are doing here in the United States. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or the CD, or the audio tape of my talk. We hope you want to get the talk on the forbidden secret, because there is a secret that's been out there for 5,000 years. And you need to understand that secret to understand what is going on in the world today. So that is the Forbidden Secret DVD. There's a syllabus that goes with that. If you want to understand even more, why we have a four-tape, a four-CD set, which is an answer to Rhonda Byrne's very popular DVD and or book, which has sold millions of copies. And our four-tape or four-CD set is called The Secret Behind the Secret. And then, of course, that's The Secret Behind the Secret. We have material on the supernatural. We have a four-tape set on that, a CD set. We also have a book that goes with that, entitled The Beautiful Side of Evil by Johanna Michelson, who is a medium. And then, of course, we have a book written by Malachi Martin, Hostage to the Devil, and the four-tape set, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin. There is so much more to know, but, well, we're out of time. Remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.